Okay, guys, very welcome back to the show. And I've got a very, very special guest on the show today, a man that you will recognize from your screens and your childhood, much so like myself, seeing him on WWF television. It's Duke the Dumpster Dross. How are you doing today, man?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me. You know, you've a very memorable character that people will remember, and we're going to talk about that in a little while. First, we're going to start out by, what are you doing now? You were talking to me a bit off camera. You've got some stuff yourself, that some shows that you're working on. Do you want to tell the fans what you're doing?
In the podcast world, I've got kind of a, I don't know if I'd call it a wrestling podcast, but I call it Trash Cam Live, you know, based on my character, Duke the Dumpster from the 90s wrestling. But, and we just get on there. We talk about anything. We talk about wrestling. We talk about UFC. We talk about anything that's going on in the news. We talk. And then apart from that, that's on Saturdays. And on Friday evenings, I've got a podcast for people that struggle with addiction, because that's the line of work I am in now, what we call the shoot job. The real job in life now is I'm kind of basically like a case manager, treatment provider, like a counselor and a probation officer all wrapped up in one. And I work with people that are facing jail and prison time, that have drug and alcohol problems and mental health issues. And we give them an opportunity to come out and try to make their life right under very, very strict supervision, of course, but we give them the opportunity and we give them hopefully the tools. And that's what I'm doing now. And the second podcast is based on that. It's called the Recovery Podcast, real simple. And we get on there and we kind of help each other along. We talk about what's going on, because I've had a past with drug and alcohol issues. So that's kind of how I got into that.
Yeah, you've been pretty open with that in the past. I have seen you talk about it before. Did that kind of, if you want to talk about it, that part of your life, did that stem from being in the wrestling business, being on the road, kind of living that rock and roll kind of lifestyle?
100%. Yeah, 100%. Back, and especially back in those days in the 90s, it was still under that WWF schedule of, you know, you would go 3 or 4 weeks straight wrestling every single night, and then maybe go home for 2 or 3 days to long enough to do your laundry and take a nap and go back and get on another plane and do it again. And, you know, people talk about wrestling being fake, and yes, it's predetermined and it's entertainment, but you still can't fake hitting the ring and hitting the ground and hitting the things, or getting hit with chairs, or all these things that take a toll on the human body and people don't realize. And that's how a lot of guys get wrapped up and to start doing drugs to give them some relief on the nightly basis of the beating. You know, I always compare pro wrestling to getting in a mild to moderate car accident every single day of the week, because that's what it's like. And you feel like you've been in a car accident every single day of the week when you're on the road, and it wears you down. So sometimes guys will start taking things to help them, like pain medication. And some people start to dabble in alcohol and things like that. And the craziness of the schedule, you know, sometimes we got to be asleep at a certain time, and we got to be awake at a certain time to get on planes and go here and do this. And you know, oftentimes the ones that decide to try and use a little bit of extra chemical assistance run into problems. And that's exactly where it started for me, was the world of professional wrestling. And it was for those reasons in the beginning, and then it just became a huge problem later on. So, but luckily I found my way out of it, and now I have the opportunity to kind of hopefully show some others how to get out of that lifestyle.
Yeah, and it's great, because we've seen so many guys over the years die so young in that business, you know, from various things you just touched on as well.
Yeah, it's sad, man. I know a lot of guys that have died, you know, from drug issues, drug overdoses, but also indirectly, you know, the stuff that goes along with it, which is, you know, depression and mental health issues. Guys have committed suicide and gone out other ways. And it's just, it's sad. It's always sad to hear of another wrestler dying at a young age. You know, I've kind of been looking over the last, I don't know how many years, at average age of wrestlers that have passed away. And I think right now it looks to me like basically The average lifespan of a wrestler these days is maybe 60 to 63 years old, if they're lucky. If they're lucky. That's if they weren't crazy or partiers or drug addicted. And they, if they had other issues, then sometimes it's 40 or 50s or, you know, could be even younger. But that's the reality. At least that's what a lot of what the wrestling business was. It's changed a lot now, and I have to hand the promoters that much. You know, the McMahon family, when they started the wellness program and they were willing to send anybody that ever worked for them to a rehab if necessary, that was a great thing. So people are making the right moves, and they're to make sure that their athletes are healthier physically and mentally. And that's important. And it's good to see that. But a lot of us, we were out there just trudging along when it was a lot more difficult and a lot more work. But, you know, it's funny. I did a convention a couple of years ago. I did a, the WrestleCon they have when they have WrestleMania. Yeah. This was when it was in New York. It might've been 3 or 4 years ago, but sitting right next to me at a table was Rikishi. And I've been friends with Rikishi for years, but I hadn't seen him in person in years. And I walked up and the first thing he said is, "We made it. We survived." And I looked at him kind of funny, like, "Why is he saying that?" And then I thought about it, and he goes, and I thought about it, and I go, "Damn, he's right." Because a lot of the guys we were with did not make it in those years. You know, you look at some of those old cards. I was in a locker room once a few years back with Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. It was an independent show in New York, and we were just kind of sitting there talking, and somebody had an old Madison Square Garden wrestling card from the 90s. And it was from when all of us were there. It was like we were on the card. It was like we were the only three that were still alive on that card. It was something. It was insane. There was like 10 people off of this wrestling card that had passed away at a relatively early age. So, yeah, it's definitely – it was a problem in the past. As I said, I think it's getting better now, though, and I hope they continue to improve and the guys get healthier, you know, because it can be a difficult lifestyle.
Yeah, and of course, Amanda, I don't know if you knew Virgil. He was obviously the most high-profile one to pass away lately. Supposed to be an amazing Virgil. Kind of character. Never talked to the dude, but he seems like a good guy.
Virgil's an interesting character, man. Virgil, you know, he wasn't the most talented guy. He wasn't like this charismatic figure. He didn't cut great promos. He just... You know, some people say a couple of the opportunities that he got were a result of promoters trying to play a rib on another promoter. You know, like they brought him in as Virgil to make fun of Dusty Rhodes, and then WCW brought him in as Vincent to make fun of Vince McMahon. But still, he was involved in some of the biggest storylines with some of the biggest factions you could ever imagine in this business, and he was there. And, you know, he was somewhat of a controversial character in the convention scene, the Comic-Con scene, because people would say he was he would try to scam people and stuff like that. But, you know, he was an old school carny guy, man. You know, the old carnies, they'll get you. It just like at the carnivals, the people running the games and stuff like that, they're going to get their marks and they're going to make their money. And he was one of those guys, man. He was always trying to make that almighty dollar, but he was deep down, he was a good guy, and he was a really nice guy. He had some outlandish stories that you knew he would tell these stories, and you knew they weren't true, but I would still love sitting there listening to him because they were hilarious. And he deep down was a good dude, man. And it's sad, you know, he got sick there at the end and all the things that happened, but I'm here to say he was deep down, he was a good dude.
Yeah, we'll rewind back anyway, and we'll discuss, like, how did you initially decide that you wanted to go into this wrestling game?
I was a fan when I was growing up I grew up in Miami, Florida, most of my life, and I used to watch Championship Wrestling from Florida with Gordon Solie and all the guys that used to go through there, man. Anybody that was ever a big name went through there at some point in time, and so I used to watch that wrestling, and I was always interested in it. I used to go to the live events whenever they had a loop where every week on Wednesday they came down close enough so I could go watch them. they would go to the Miami Beach Convention Center. So I'd go watch it live every week. And then WrestleMania 1. When WrestleMania number 1 happened, my dad took me to watch it at the Miami Beach Convention Center on a closed circuit television because they didn't have pay-per-view then. It was just on closed circuit. You had to go to an arena near you, and they showed it on a big screen. And you pay and sit in the seats and watch it on the big screen. And that's what we did. And I watched it. And I just remember around that time was when WWF really started pumping their TV into Florida more so than before. Before that, you didn't see much New York wrestling. But then WrestleMania 1, of course, is when Vince really started to try. He started taking over the world, starting with the United States. And you would see their TV and the buildup. The way they put together that entire show, but especially the main event with Hulk Hogan and Mr. T versus Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff, that's what hooked me. That's what got me. And I remember as we were watching it in that arena up on the big screen, and during that match, I just remember at one point, I was in high school at that time, and I remember I stood up and I looked at my dad. I go, that's what I want to do right there. That is what I want to do. I want to be a professional wrestler. And from that point forward, that's what I mainly worked on, was becoming a pro wrestler. And that's how it all started.
And what was your kind of training process like then? And who trained you and where did you train?
There was a guy locally down there in Florida. His name was Bobby Wales, the Jamaican Jammer, they called him. And he would sometimes be the tag team partner with Tyree Pride, the Haitian sensation down in Florida. They did tag matches for championship wrestling from Florida. Tyree Pride even wrestled Ric Flair on a couple of occasions for the championship down in Miami. But Bobby Wales was the guy. He had a ring in a warehouse. And there was a group of maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 of us that he was training. And we would just show up. I don't know, it was like 3 or 4 days a week if we, you know, and he ended up giving me a key eventually, and I went in every single day, and if nobody was there, I just rolled up carpets and practiced doing moves on him. But he's the guy that trained me. He also trained Norman Smiley. Norman Smiley was there in those days too. They used to call him Black Magic, and he was training with us as well. But there was just a small group of guys. It was just a ring in a warehouse, nothing fancy, and we learned, you know, the basics of professional wrestling. That's the guy I learned it from, this guy, Bobby Wales, who's a great teacher.
So watching WrestleMania 1 with your dad, that's when it all started. How do you end up working for the biggest wrestling company in the world in 1994?
It's an interesting story. I started, you know, I learned from Bobby Wales, and then I started doing local Florida shows, independents. Back then it was a lot different. There was a lot fewer shows to do, but wherever I could, I would do wrestle on shows down there. We went to the Caribbean a few times and wrestled in the Bahamas and stuff. But at the same time, I was going to college at the University of Miami. And I had college for free because my mother worked for the university. So I had to take that opportunity before I decided to try and go wrestle. So I did that. Anyway, all of that, I got my bachelor's degree in criminal justice because that's what interested me. And I was making this big plan to just travel the country and go to different promotions. I had a promotional tape, a bunch of highlight reels and wrestling matches and promos on a tape that me and my brother put together. And I had a resume and pictures I had made. And at that time I was wrestling as the Garbage Man Rocco Gibralta, interestingly enough, because I knew that was the kind of character that like a Vince McMahon would probably want for the WWF. Well, what ended up happening is, interestingly, I finished school. I was getting ready to go. And I was getting ready to just get in my car and drive. And I read in the paper that they were having something called the NATP convention, which is a television executive convention where TV executives come and they buy and sell shows to networks and things. And they were doing it at the Miami Beach Convention Center, the same place. And this was during the time where Vince was in the middle of the steroid scandal. And he went to federal court and all that stuff, and he was acquitted of all the charges. Well, they were interviewing this guy in the paper. They were interviewing Hulk Hogan, of all people. He was there. But Hulk Hogan had just jumped to WCW. He was still a babyface, but he had just gone to WCW, and they were talking to him. And they were talking to him about the steroid scandal. And then the last thing they said in this article was Vince McMahon, who was also in attendance at the convention, had no comment. And I realized at that moment, Vince McMahon was locally in my town. He was in my hometown, and I had to do something. So I concocted within the next probably 10 or 12 hours, I concocted a scheme. I knew somebody that was a TV executive for a local PBS station, Channel 2 in Miami, and he had the credentials you needed to get into this convention. He let me borrow his credentials. I wore a suit. I put his name tag around my neck, and I walked right in the damn front door. And I walked right up to Vince McMahon at the WWF booth. And I shook his hand, and I told him I wanted to wrestle for him. I gave him a promotional package with the tape and everything. And he was pretty impressed that I had the balls to do that, because at that point, nobody had ever done that before. And he had J.J. Dillon, who was talent relations at that time, call me about a week later, and they brought me up for a tryout. So I didn't have to drive all over the country.
That is quality. What did he say to you? What did he say when you handed him that tape?
When I walked up, he saw, it was like he looked at me, he looked at the credentials, and he smiled. And as I walked up and I reached out my hand and shook his hand, I said, "My name's Mike Drosy. I live here locally in Miami, Florida, and I've been wrestling for about 9 years, and I would like to work for you in the World Wrestling Federation." He goes, "Aha." He goes, "So you've been wrestling for 9 years? You mean you've been a professional wrestler?" I said, "Yes. I've been wrestling part-time while I've been going to college and finishing school at the University of Miami." And he goes, "So you just graduated from college?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Well, then why do you want to do this?" And I said, "Mr. McMahon, you know, in life, you have what I call the normal run-of-the-mill route where you go to college and you get a career and you work 9 to 5. And then you have your dreams in life. And professional wrestling is my dream. So I'm going to chase my dream. Now that I've got a college degree, I'm going to give my dream of professional wrestling a chance and see if I can do it. And that's why I'd like to work for you." And he was just like, "Okay, well, thank you very much." I said, "At your earliest convenience, if you could take a look at this, I would greatly appreciate it." He said, "I absolutely will." And then I got the hell out of there. And the funny thing was, I wasn't even panicked building up to it and going in the front door and stuff. I was on a mission. But as soon as I walked back out of there and got into my car to go home, I started shaking and sweating. And I was like,
just thinking about it.
I couldn't believe what I just done. But, you know, that was the only way, man, because I didn't have a friend or a brother or an uncle that worked there. I had to figure out a way. And that was my way. This is the way that I figured out. It worked.
A week later, then you got the phone call, you go up there. What was it like actually stepping into that kind of dressing room? A, particularly because I know it was obviously, you may or may not have been nervous. I'd assume you probably were nervous. And then B, as you referred to earlier, it was just after the steroid trial. What was the kind of atmosphere like there?
It was interesting. You know, it was a lot of those guys were guys that I actually came up in the business watching on TV. And I mean, hell, I even wrestled Scott Hall back when I was 18 years old, back in the Florida Championship Wrestling from Florida. I actually went up and did a TV job one day wearing a hood. And I kind of reminded him of that. And he actually still had the tape when he went home and he watched it. But a lot of those guys, they were the people that I idolized. So it was an interesting, it was like this exercise in acting like I belonged there, but also keeping my excitement at bay, because I was like, I can't believe I'm freaking in this locker room with these dudes. But it was a great feeling and it was fun. However, it was also, there was difficult times because, like you said, the steroid scandal and the money was down, the fans were not coming out to see us as much, and it was harder to make money. And that started to set in pretty quickly after I started working full time. I realized, wow, just because you get hired by the biggest company in the world doesn't mean you're automatically a rich superstar. You got to still work your way up this ladder. And So that's what I started working on. And, you know, but that's kind of what my first impression it was walking in.
Yeah, I talked to a guy who done photography there for over 20 years, and he said that was the only time that, you know, he really feared for the business. He said he actually had to pay some of his photography staff at times because there wasn't enough money to pay those guys. He did get the money back then from WWF at the time, but things were very tight there from a money standpoint.
Yeah, it was difficult. It was definitely trying times.
Yeah. One guy that you wrestled early on, the WWF, a guy that, you know, he's a fantastic wrestler, and I'd like to see him get some kind of recognition for everything he's done to the business, would be Barry Horowitz. What's your opinion on Barry and his wrestling ability?
I love Barry Horowitz, man. We're still friends to this day. Barry was always an interesting character to wrestle because Barry Horowitz was a guy that, you know, he would come in for TV at certain times. He would come in for the TV tapings, and he would be what's called an enhancement talent. He's there to make, you know, their stars look good. But sometimes guys like Barry Horowitz and the Brooklyn Brawler, they didn't get the memo on that. They went out and tried to get themselves over at the expense.
Yeah.
And if you were inexperienced, even though you were supposed to be a superstar, if you didn't watch your ass, they would take over and, you know, put themselves over during a lot of the match to make themselves look good, and you'd end up looking silly. So you had to really pay attention and not let them take over like the whole match. And I saw them eat guys alive in the ring. But I was always kind of ready for it. So, and I had great matches with Barry. He always was a great wrestler, a great technical wrestler, and always willing to try anything. And again, he's still a friend of mine to this day, and he's a great dude.
Any memories? I know you wrestled him in 94 when you got in there, of Owen Hart. I've heard nothing but really nice stories about that man.
Yeah, they're all really nice stories, and they're all really true. And he was a good dude. He was a pain in the ass with his ribs, but it was hilarious. It was funny ribs. It wasn't mean, spiteful ribs like that hurt people. It was always funny stuff. I always make the comment that Owen was one of the few guys I could count on one hand that was loyal to his wife and kids, because, you know, a lot of wrestlers aren't, but or weren't back in those days. But Owen was. He was a family man. He loved his family. He loved his wife and kids. And that was a very tragic thing that happened, and the way it happened. I remember I had already gone home and left the WWF right before that happened. Well, and right before, it was actually a couple of years before, but I was still watching the pay-per-views, and I just remember sitting there watching it in disbelief at what was going on. But yeah, Owen was something else. I remember my first week there, he ribbed me with the old hotel telephone. He called me at like 2 a.m. in my hotel room saying he was Domino's Pizza trying to deliver me a pizza, and he didn't know where the hell I was, and I gave him the wrong room number. And I sat there and argued with him until I realized, oh, this is, you know, I thought about it, and I go, this is Owen Hart. And so I finally hung up and then took the phone off the hook so he couldn't call me anymore. And then apparently the next day in the locker room, apparently he had brought one of those old school voicemail recorders. You know, back in the old days, they had the cassette tape for your answering machine. He brought the whole answer machine on the road and tape recorded the whole interaction between me and him and played it for the other wrestlers in the locker room. And I just remember thinking, oh, these sons of bitches, man. These people are cutthroat, man. I got to watch my ass around these people. But
Ahmed Johnson told me a good story that Owen had pranked him pretending to be from the Jay Leno show, and to get a suit, you're coming on the Jay Leno show. And Ahmed was waiting outside in his suit for this limo to arrive that never did.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's Owen Hart right there. Perfect example. Yeah Owen always had great jokes.
So when was the next time you bumped into Vince, and did he ever mention how you guys had met and you given him the tape? Did you ever have any interactions with him over the years after that?
Oh yeah, all the time. You know, I always felt like I could go and talk to Vince about any issues I was having or any concerns or things like that. So I talked to him quite often back in those days. But yeah, Vince, when I was there for the tryout, he came up and he thanked me for coming. And at the end of it, he said, all the guys really liked me, seemed to like me, and everything looks good, and that they would be in touch with me very soon. And then, you know, after that, it was great for a while. And then, you know, then I just think that the Garbage Man, they didn't see any other potential in storylines with Duke the Dumpster. So it kind of cooled off, and when I started to become concerned about that, it was our relationship kind of changed, and then by that point I was taking drugs on the road to kind of get by, and so I was a little more erratic in my talk, in the way I was acting, you know, and I would be more, I wasn't like hostile towards him, but I was more angry in our conversations about, you know, the fact that they weren't doing anything with me, and our relationship changed. And then he didn't talk to me as much after that, you know, it kind of changed. But, you know, there was a lot of things I didn't know. Like I told you, I thought walking through the front door, you were going to be a rich superstar, and that wasn't the case. But there was a lot of other things I didn't know either. And, which is okay. I mean, now I look back and I realized a lot of things, you know, that I was kind of clueless about, But he was a very shrewd businessman. I will tell you that. Vince McMahon was a promoter extraordinaire. And sometimes he would tell you something was going to happen and then it didn't happen. And he would say, well, plans change. I remember King Kong Bundy coming back in 95, 96, or whatever it was, 94 even. And he came in with a lot of fanfare, but it just wasn't the same Bundy, you know, as WrestleMania 2. And they just kind of went cold on him and they weren't pushing him so much. And I remember him sitting in the locker room one day and he goes, man, I don't know what happened. I came in. He says, Vince said he's going to push me to the moon. And then he goes, then he puts me with the $1 million corporation and nothing happens. And I went to Vince and I said, Vince, I thought we were going to push me to the moon. And he said, Vince looked at him and said, it just didn't happen, Chris. It just didn't happen. And that's kind of how plans would change, man. And if you didn't know how to handle that type of situation, you could take it personally and get very angry. And those are the people that didn't last long.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that didn't last long because they took shit personally and they got pissed off and they took their ball and went home. But unlike Steve Austin, nobody noticed when I did it.
We'll talk about Steve Austin in a little bit, but 95 and 96, you made two Royal Rumble appearances. What was it like being in matches like that? Obviously, probably much different than the normal match. And was it kind of erratic then as well, or was it well planned out, those matches?
Well, they were pretty well planned out. Pat Patterson put those together, and he was pretty good at organizing that stuff. It was always a bittersweet kind of thing for me to be in the Royal Rumble because honestly, during most of my 2.5 year tenure there, that was the only pay-per-view match I was ever on. I was never in singles pay-per-views until I wrestled Triple H the one time on In Your House. But other than that, I had never had a singles pay-per-view match. And they never put me in any kind of storyline for any pay-per-views. But I could always count on the Royal Rumble. I would be in that one. And but it was always fun. It was always really easy because you just they would put it all, like I said, we would all meet in catering, and they'd have a big like whiteboard, and Pat Patterson would write everybody's order when you go out to the ring and when you get thrown out of the ring and who throws you out and also who goes out before you. Because then you see, you'd be looking, you know, you're getting close. You see the guy that's going out before you and you see him go. And then you got to find the guy that's going to put you out. And when, you know, you find him, and I remember one, I think it was 95, where Shawn Michaels threw me out. You know, that was one of those years where he went out number one and won the whole thing. And he threw me out and threw a little extra elbow grease into it. And poor Earl Hebner was standing outside the ring. You know, all the rest would stand outside the ring. And I went, wham, I just landed right on top of him. It's on YouTube. I squashed him.
I seen it.
Fuck, Duke. And I went, I'm so sorry. I was going, I'm so sorry, Earl. But, you know, there was always shit like that going on. A lot of guys didn't take it very seriously. We'd get in punching and kicking each other and laughing and goofing off. But Owen Hart was ribbing everybody. I remember in one of these battle royals, I don't know if it was the Royal Rumble or not, Owen was sitting up on the corner turnbuckle, and I had my back turned towards him, and he reached out and grabbed me by the hair and pulled me in to him. And he used to wear that black singlet. He took part of his singlet off his shoulder, and he wrapped it around my face. Well, he hadn't washed that singlet in months, and you could smell it smelled so bad. And I just remember going, what the fuck are you doing? And he's just giggling, laughing his ass off, because that's the way he was. And that's the kind of stuff that would go on in those battle royals and even the Royal Rumbles. You guys are in there goofing around. It's like when I went back for the gimmick battle royal. Holy shit. You want to talk about a bunch of old timers not taking anything seriously. It was pandemonium in the ring during the gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania 17.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that as well in a little while. Did you ever get any guidance from people there about the character, about the promos, about direction? I know you kind of alluded to there a while ago that they didn't really have a long-term plan for you.
Yeah, I mean, you were always getting input from people, but the thing about it was that sometimes the input wasn't coming from a good place. You know, sometimes people, like Chief J. Strongbow, never gave me a good piece of advice ever when I was there. Mm-hmm. He was a mean old son of a bitch. And if he didn't like you, you were fucked as far as he was concerned. He wasn't going to do anything to help you. Now, Tony Garea, on the other hand, was the greatest agent ever, because he would always give me legitimate, honest suggestions and find ways to, and everything he ever gave me worked and helped me. Tony Garea and Rene Goulet were both great guys. George Animal Steel was okay sometimes, you know, most of the time. But yeah, Chief J. Strongbow was miserable, a miserable son of a bitch from day one. And he and I didn't get along, and it was just the way it is. Some of those guys had like access to grind, and you know, if you weren't one of the top guys, they treated you like complete shit. So you always had to be careful about the advice you were getting on characters or storylines, and see where it was coming from, and just be very wary about where you were getting these suggestions from and who they came from, because some guys would try to derail your career just because they were spiteful individuals.
We touched on him earlier. We'll talk about him now. I was looking at an old podcast of yours where you were talking about wrestling Steve Austin and an interaction with Bret Hart, if you want to tell people about that, because I think it's a great story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, both of those guys, I rode with them on the road quite a bit. We would rent cars together and ride. Both were cool individuals to be around and listen to and learn from. Steve always had better advice for me. I think so. A lot of times Bret Hart was kind of winding me up and playing jokes on me, because he did come from the same family as Owen Hart, after all. And I think sometimes they had fun at other people's expenses. And I think he did that to me sometimes. Like, he would tell me to call Vince at his house and shit and give me his phone number. And I was like, you need to call Vince. And I was like, you know, I would call Vince. And he would be real nice to me. But then I would think about it afterwards. I go, I shouldn't have called him at home. That was stupid. And I just knew somewhere Bret Hart was just having a giggle at my expense. But that was kind of the way it is. And again, you know, as I said before, in a lot of ways, I was clueless. Now, Austin, man, he was just fun. He had no axe to grind. He didn't have any enemies, really, at that time. You know, he wasn't the big star yet, so he wasn't like, yeah, he was paranoid or anything about anybody around him. He was just working his way up the ladder and having a good time doing it. And we had a blast. But yeah, it was interesting hanging out with those guys and watching how they carried themselves. You know, a guy that was working his way up and a guy that was already up there, you know. I think sometimes the advice that Bret Hart used to give me was based on Bret Hart advice, like advice Bret Hart should get because he's the champion, not Duke the Dumpster advice. So I think that was kind of the difference as well sometimes, but you know, it was all good, man. I certainly don't regret any of the time I spent there or who I hung out with, you know, because there were some very bitter motherfuckers. You could hang out with somebody that was negative and bitter and it would be the worst trip of your life. But if you had fun people to hang out with that made it a fun experience, even though nobody was making any real big money at the time, at least it wasn't, you know, totally a total loss, you know, and it wasn't so difficult to live on the road like that, even though it was difficult, but it made it a lot easier, you know, hanging out with guys like that.
Yeah. Talk to me then about that extensive run, both on house show and TV and leading up to the In Your House pay-per-view then with Triple H. You guys worked a hell of a lot of matches together. What was it like working with him?
You know, it's a funny story because I got to go all the way back to actually when Steve Austin came in to the WWF then. Because the reason I say that is Steve Austin came in and they made him the ringmaster, right? Well, yeah. At that time, I was well into the almost at the end of my second year, which is the first initial contract is 2 years, right? And my second year was about to end. And at that point, they had already stopped really using me much. You know, I was still being flown in for TV, but every once in a while, I'd do a match where I had to lose to a new heel that came in or something like a Vader or a Mankind or whatever. But otherwise, I wasn't wrestling much and I wasn't on the road much and I wasn't making money and I was getting frustrated. Well, Steve Austin comes in, and this is one of those days at TV where I walked in and I looked at the list and my name wasn't on it. So I just left all my shit in the car, man, my wrestling gear and everything. I just left it in the car. I was like, man, I'll just go sit around again and wait for Bret, because I was riding with him at the time. Well, at the last second, I want to say it was Bruce Pritchard came running up. He goes, get your gear. You're going to wrestle this the new guy, Steve Austin. And I went, okay. And I just remember I walked in the locker room. I was like kind of pissed already. I was like, here we go again. Gotta do the job. And I sat down, opened up my bag, and I was sitting next to Bret, and I told him what was going on, and he goes, I wouldn't do it. I'd refuse to do it. And I just remember sitting there going, is that an option? You know? And he goes, no. He goes, just you can refuse to do it. And I went, okay. So I went and walked into Vince's office, and he wasn't there, but Bruce was there. And I sat down, and I go, look, I need to know what the hell you guys want me to do, because obviously I'm not doing it right now, because the way you're using me is garbage, and I'm not making any money, and I'm struggling to make a living at all. So I don't know what you want me to do. But here I am once again, losing to the newest heel, and there's no purpose. And he saw that I was really upset, and he kind of got nervous. And I think he also realized that my 2-year contract was almost over. And he ran and he goes, Don't worry about it. You don't have to do it. No problem. And they figured that out and blah, blah, blah. And I guess he went and talked to Vince. But I went back in the locker room, and I just remember I sat down and I told Brett, I said, I told him, man, they're not going to make me do it. And Rikishi, who was Fatu then, Fatu was sitting right across, and he looked at me, he goes, you need to go tell Steve what's going on. So I walked over and I sat down next to Austin. He goes, I hear we're working together tonight. And I said, no, brother, we're not going to. He goes, no. I said, no, man, listen, and this has nothing to do with you, but I'm at a point right now where my contract's about up and they've been killing me lately. And I picked this moment to take a stand. And I just want you to know it has nothing to do with you personally. It was just, this was the moment I had to do it. And he goes, man, if anybody understands, I do. Because he just came from that shit show at WCW. And we became really good friends after that. So Vince talks to me the next day at TV. He says, I'm asking him, I'm going, what do I need to do differently? He goes, you're doing it now. And I said, okay. And he goes, yeah, we're going to put you in a storyline with this or that. And then Triple H, you know, it was like, okay, good. So we set up this storyline with Triple H. And I remember going into the office with Vince and Bruce and Jim Ross and Jerry Briscoe, and we're all sitting there and we're talking about it. And I'm talking about long term. I'm going, okay, where am I going to go after this? I go, in fact, you know, we were talking about turning me heel at that point. I said, I'd like to turn heel and kind of change my appearance and maybe even get rid of the whole garbage man thing altogether eventually. But I want to change my appearance, maybe cut my hair. Now, as soon as I said cut my hair, Jim Ross chimed in. He goes, well, you know, if you want to cut your hair, we can make it part of the angle and let Triple H cut your hair off as part of this. And I remember sitting back in that room and looking at all these guys sitting around and the way they were looking at me. And I went, look, I know I'm not going to beat him. I know I'm not going to cut his hair. So I'll do this as long as I have some way of getting revenge afterwards. And they, Vince McMahon said, absolutely. Yes. Blah, blah, blah. We're going to do it. So we go out, we do it. We do the whole deal. We set it up. We do the free for all match where I beat him by disqualification, mind you. I beat him by disqualification. I could never pin anybody. And then he got mad.
Still a W.
Yeah.
Still a W. No.
Yes. And then he came back the next week at TV and jumped me from behind and cut my hair off. Then we're off to the races. We got closer time for the pay-per-view and everything. So in this time, I re-signed the one-year rollover, right? And it seemed like as soon as the ink wasn't even dry on the extension, and they were like, all right, you're just going to get killed in this match too. You're going to lose and whatever, you know. And I remember we had these conversations. I used to sit there, and it was like, in the free-for-all match, he hit me with brass knuckles and got disqualified, right? You remember that? He hit me with brass knuckles and knocked me out. And Gorilla Monsoon came out as the commissioner, and he switched the decision, and I won. Yet he comes out on In Your House, and he hits me in the face with the trash can lid. No Gorilla Monsoon. I'm sitting there going, if it happened this time, why is it not going to happen this time?
Consistency.
No, and they didn't care. They were like, this match doesn't fucking matter. They're just like, go out and do it. Because by that point, I had no bargaining chip because I re-signed. So they weren't as nice to me anymore. And Vince's exact words were, to show up like you always do with a smile on your face and do your job. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, this is fucking ridiculous. I go, he's got me. There's nothing I can do. I have zero bargaining position. And there's nothing I can do. Am I going to walk out? You know, I might as well have because I never went back. But, you know, I didn't. I didn't walk out or anything like that. But and then after that, I complained so much after all that was over, I complained every week at TV to the point where Vince said, go ahead and go on home. And I was just freaking 4 months into the new year contract. I sat home for 8 months, couldn't go wrestle anywhere, do anything. But that's how it all went down.
And obviously they paid you for those 8 months then as well, yeah?
Hell no.
No? No?
No, because look, and a lot of guys will tell you this, because this is how it was. During those days, when you signed on with the WWF, all you were signing on for was a chance to work there. Mm. And their only guarantee to you, to most guys, even Steve Austin walked in on the same deal. 10 matches a year, $150 per match, $1,500 total, and that's all your guarantee was. And I had already met that, so they didn't have to pay me anything else. I went home and sat. And this, you know, I mean, I could have demanded a release or whatever and done some things, but to me, it didn't really matter because I could have gone and wrestled as the garbage man because I did that before I went there. But you know, I just sat. I sat home and just so I didn't make any waves because I didn't know how the legal part of it worked. I was just so disgusted with the business at that point that I was done. And I never really made it back. And I'll tell you this too. We talked earlier about drugs and alcohol and stuff. You know, I was on drugs and alcohol pretty bad at that point. And when I left the WWF, there was no longer a reason to get clean and sober for the next road trip. You know, at least they had you organized to the point where they had you on the road and you had to be somewhere. Well, I was just at home and the brakes were off. I was just doing whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, how much I wanted. And plus, I didn't have to take drug tests anymore. In WWF, at least they drug tested you. You couldn't do illegal drugs or steroids or anything like that. But still, I went home and just spiraled out of control. So, You know, that's kind of how it went down. But yeah, that was the end of my experience there.
You did do, I was reading a dark match in WCW. Was there ever a chance to get more of a run there, or how did that opportunity come about?
Yes. And it was interesting because once my last eight months of my WWF contract was up, I actively tried to go to WCW. Now, what I did was I just walked in the back at a Nitro taping, at a Nitro show. I just walked in. I was wearing a suit and I just walked in. I was like, I don't give
the
a
trusty,
shit.
The trusty suit again.
That's it. I walked in with my little suit on, and it didn't exactly go the same way. Now, they didn't kick me out. It's interesting. Everybody was so nice to me because they thought somebody had brought me in. But then, like, the next day and the next 2 days at other TV tapings, when people started realizing nobody brought me in, the way they were treating me changed. They weren't as nice. However, I will say J.J. Dillon had already jumped ship, and he was at WCW then. And I guess he was handling their talent relations. And he came running over and gave me his number and said, call me. We're going to, you know, we could do something and whatever. Well, he ended up setting me up for a tryout. I had to go in and do that dark match, right? Well, at the same time, I was also talking again to the WWF. And what ended up happening is I had both of those tryouts. They made me try out again, too. And I had both of those probably within a couple of weeks of each other, I think. And I just remember trying to figure out what I should do. Did I really want to go to WCW, or did I want to go back to WWF? Because you could kind of feel the tide was turning at that point. And WWF was kind of – WCW was still on fire. But WWF was coming back. And I remember asking two people for advice, Bret Hart and Steve Austin. And Bret Hart said, I think you should do both of them. That's the professional thing to do. You should do both. And I said, okay. And then I asked Steve Austin. And he goes, You better pick which one you want to do and just do that one. Pick the company you want to go to and just do that one, because these are fucking vindictive people. Unfortunately, I took Brett's advice. I did both, and nobody called.
Wow. But the phone did call for WrestleMania 17. Was that a surprise? And who called you? And what was the kind of explanation like on the match?
Well, first of all, they didn't call me. I called them. It was an interesting thing that happened. I was working for the independent company down in Florida that I had wrestled for before I went to WWF. It was called Sunshine Wrestling Federation. By that point, they had changed their name. They bought the name Florida. They were calling themselves Florida Championship Wrestling. And then later, WWF bought that name from them and made it one of their early developmental programs. But I was working for them. I had a wrestling ring. I was training their wrestlers down there in Florida. I was still all messed up, doing a lot of drugs and drinking. And somebody, a local wrestler, came to me one day at a practice, and he goes, "Did you hear?" I said, "No, hear what?" He goes, "They're doing a gimmick battle royal, man. You need to call somebody and get on that." So I found my old phone number for Bruce Pritchard, and I called him. And I just remember him going, "We've been looking all over for you." I was like, "Sure you have. Fucking sure you have." But he says, "Yeah, well, let me ask some people some things, and I'll call you back." And he called me back, I think, the next day. And he goes, "Yes, you can come up and do it," and blah, blah, blah. So I went up there, and I did the gimmick battle royal, was involved with that. It was nice. It was okay. I was kind of embarrassed. I was way out of shape. I couldn't have wrestled in a real match to save my life if I had to. I was just in a real bad way with drugs and everything. And if you look at me when I walked down to the ring, I was extremely pale and extremely skinny because I was in a bad way. But I went. I didn't talk to a lot of people in the back. I kind of hid because I was embarrassed. But overall, though, it was a good experience. It was a nice little payday. I talked to a few people, and and it was insane. The freaking Astrodome with 65,000 people in it. We didn't have anything like that when I was there. So, but it was cool. It was nice. But yeah, I called them. They didn't call me.
And you were saying about the disorganization of the match, and what way was that kind of put together with you guys in the back? Was it just chaos?
Well, again, Pat Patterson put it together. He told everybody what to do and when to do it. So in that respect, it was organized. But when we got out to the ring, everybody was just completely fucking off, laughing. And the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff were fighting against each other. And every time the Iron Sheik would hit me, he'd go, "Motherfucker Nikolai." And he would punch, and Nikolai Volkoff would go, "Ah!" He would scream this high-pitched shrill. And I just remember standing in the ring going, "What in the hell have I gotten myself into?" And I was watching Bruce Pritchard and Jim Cornette were in the corner because they were in this thing. They were in the corner fighting each other, staying the fuck away from everybody else because they didn't want to get hurt. But they were over there in the corner goofing off. And I just remember whoever was supposed to go before me went out of the ring, and Ray Apollo, Doink the Clown, was supposed to put me out, and he came flying across the ring and hit me. And to me, it was on the wrong side, and I had to underhook with both arms and ended up tearing both of my shoulders out as I went over backwards. But, yeah, that was that experience. It was pretty crazy. It was a good, everybody was goofing off in there. It was organized well enough, but they had to let Sheik win because he couldn't go over the top rope because his knees were so bad. So he had to win, and then Sergeant Slaughter had to come running in and beat him up and shoo him out of the ring and get the glory at the end. But that's, they didn't put much thought into it. They didn't care. I mean, think about it. We followed the freaking TLC match. I remember I was sitting back there going, "Oh, I hope they don't expect much from this battle royal," because these guys are flying off of 50-foot ladders and shit. But Yeah, it was fun though, but man.
It's a lot of people's favorite WrestleMania because there was so much diversity. I think there wasn't there a big hardcore match with fucking forklifts and stuff like that early in the night as well. I think Kane was involved, Crash Holly perhaps. Just trying to remember now. And of course, the night ended then with Austin and Rock.
That was, I'll tell you what stood out to me was TLC, Austin and Rock, obviously, and except I didn't like them turning Austin heel at the end. That was the only thing I didn't like. And I'll tell you another great match that nobody ever really talked about was Kurt Angle versus Chris Benoit. That was freaking amazing. I watched that live. I stood there and watched it. I was like, man, these guys are freaking going, man. So it was really impressive to me. But yeah, it was a great pay-per-view, man. And I think it probably was the best WrestleMania, even with the shitty gimmick battle royal with all the old farts in there rolling around. But it was fun.
People enjoyed it, man. People enjoyed that for sure. There was so much going on at that Mania, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't shoot it down.
Nah.
Yeah.
And that was my sort of WrestleMania moment, I guess. So there you go.
Well, nobody can ever take that from you. You know? If you look back at your time in the business, do you have a favorite opponent, a favorite match, a favorite period in your career?
This has almost become a running gag now because I always change the answer. Okay. But I'm going to tell you, the guys that I had the most fun working with at that level in the WWF, when I worked with, when Savio Vega was Quang, working with him was a blast. Working with Austin, the few times I got to work with him was fun. Working with the Hog Farmer was fun because I was good friends with Mark. I still am. And we had a great time. Basically those were the guys that I had the most fun with because I wrestled them the most. We were always like that early mid-card match, you know, down there, down on the bottom, you know, we weren't in the semi-main, no, we were way down here. Sometimes I was just plus other matches. That was my name, plus other matches at the bottom because they didn't even put my name on the card, but you always knew who they were talking about. But, those guys, those were the ones that were fun to me because we always cut up, you know, wrestling Owen Hart. Anytime you got in the ring with Owen Hart, he was always out to make the other people in the ring laugh. Some way, somehow. Always. I remember one time he came out. I don't remember what the match was. I don't even think I was in it. I think it was a lumberjack match. I think I was outside the ring. He was in the ring. And he had put some kind of hairspray in his hair. It was a house show. And he walked out, and his hair was sticking straight up to the side like this. And he came out, and he did some, I don't remember what he did. It's like he held a comb to his face and made like a Hitler mustache, you know. And this is the 90s. It's not now. But he was just doing that just to make the ref laugh or just to make us laugh. You know, the crowd didn't even know what the hell was going on. They weren't even paying attention. But Owen would do it to make us laugh. So he was always fun to work with. But yeah, those were the cool dudes, man. Definitely Savio too. I'm still good friends with all those guys. So
yeah, and Savio was only back there but last year, wasn't it? In Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Oh wow, that was a great show.
So yeah, good for him. On the flip side of it then, did you ever see guys that were just erratic and would fly off the handle and weren't easy to deal with? Do you ever have any experiences like that?
You know, I mean, there's always guys that, I mean, maybe some guys could say that of me at one point when I kind of started losing it. But I'll tell you, when I first came in, it was interesting. And I'm friends with him, both of these guys, to this day. And I tell him this all the time because eventually they did change. But when I first came in, one of the first guys I rode with was Adam Baum and Bob Holly together. And
yes,
at that point, they weren't being used very well. And they were very bitter. And it was interesting because I was just coming in, so I still had a lot of fanfare, and I was winning matches. And I was just remember sitting back going, how could you be pissed off about working here? I used to think, like, how are these guys so pissed off? Well, lo and behold, about a year later, I knew exactly how. They weren't happy. They were great to work with in the ring. Don't get me wrong. Matter of fact, me and Bob Holly tagged some against Owen and the British Bulldog, and those were fun matches. But in the beginning, those guys were kind of bitter and pissed off. Lex Luger, he would complain sometimes. He would, I remember, he was kind of misunderstood, actually. Lex was and is a really nice guy. I just remember when I got there was right around WrestleMania 10, and he was the main event, right? WrestleMania 10, part of the main event. Well, the next year, he was opening match in a tag match on WrestleMania 11. And I just remember sitting in the locker room, listening to him complain, going, how does that work? You go from main event one year to opening match in a tag the next year? How does that happen? And that's where we kind of, that's where I remember the term click coming from. We were talking about that, and I used to call it click-a-mania, not WrestleMania, but click-a-mania. I said, now, if you ain't in the click, you ain't getting in those top three or four matches, brother. That's just the way it works. You got to be in the click. And he used to laugh. But that was another thing. I'd just say whatever was on my mind. I wasn't the most politically adept individual. I would say whatever the fuck I was thinking. And sometimes that got me in trouble, but I didn't give a shit. But, yeah. Those were the guys that seemed to have issues at times. You know, Lex would be pissed off. Adam Bomb. He ended up leaving shortly thereafter. And then Bob Holly, he almost left at one point and then came back.
Yeah, he was doing the spark plug, wasn't he, at the time?
Yeah, he hated that. God, he hated that.
Yeah. He's meant to be a real tough dude, though, is he? Is everyone, like everyone says, he's a real hard hitter.
Yeah, yeah, he's just a tough dude in terms of the wear and tear he can take. He took over the years in the ring. He's a tough dude, you know. But yeah, he's a real tough dude. And to be called Thurman Sparky Plug was just like fucking. He was so bitter. I remember a little kid would come up, "What's your name?" And he'd be like Thurman Sparky Plug, and they're like, "Ew." He would get the veins would come out of his neck. Yeah, yeah. That's when they changed it to Bob Holly, Bob Sparkplug Holly. They changed his name, and he was still a race car driver. And then eventually, like well after I left, they made him Hardcore Holly, which was the greatest thing they ever did. So, yeah, he was a tough dude.
In terms of you now, we're wrapping up the interview shortly. What's the condition of your body like? Because I talk to people that obviously put their bodies, their lives on the line, really going in there. How has it affected you long term down the road?
Like most wrestlers, I'm a wreck. One wrestling injury years ago, and ended up I had to have my left foot amputated. I've got a prosthetic leg on the left side because I had such a bad injury. And after surgery, I got an infection in the foot. My right hip has to be replaced. This shoulder is going to be need to be replaced. My spine is a wreck, and I'm really afraid to get spinal surgery. So I'm putting that off as long as I can. But that's the wear and tear. That's the wrestling legacy of so many guys that, you know, we thought we put our bodies on the line every night for years and years. And in a lot of ways, I guess we thought we were invincible. And I remember guys used to joke, someday some of us will be in the Hall of Fame. They're going to have to wheel us out there. Well, it's coming true. You know, your body and the rings and everything were a lot different back then, man. There wasn't as much safety precautions in place. So a lot of the guys that I worked with and knew from those days are beat up pretty bad. So like Barry's having issues with his knee. Last time we did a convention together, man, he was really having difficulty getting around. His leg was really hurting him. And it's just that it comes back on you, man. The older you get, the stuff gets worse. So, you know, eventually you got to go under the knife in hopes that you can get it fixed. Sometimes that presents even more problems than it's worth. But, you know, that's just kind of how it goes. It's something we knew what we were getting into. And we accepted it. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And I'm fine with it. You know, but yeah, definitely got problems.
In terms of the current product Do you keep in touch with any wrestling? If so, what do you watch?
I don't regularly watch any company at all. I catch highlights of WWE and AEW stuff, or I keep up with a lot of the news from those wrestling companies on things like TikTok and other social media. I do have the Peacock network, so sometimes I'll still catch whatever WWE has on there, you know, whatever show or pay-per-view they're putting on. Sometimes I'll catch a little bit of that, but I really don't. I've always told people it's difficult to sit through wrestling now because they'll be like, do you still watch wrestling? And I'm like, no. And they're like, why? And I say, because it's the same exact storylines over and over and over. They just changed the names and the personalities. But it's, if you really look and you dig deep, a lot of these storylines have been done over and over and over. So it's like every once in a while they'll come up with something fresh and I'll go, ah, now that's good. That's interesting. I don't think I've seen
it's one more. It's more like it's a TV show now, isn't it? It's entertainment. It's not
it's almost like a movie, like a movie production now, more so than even just a TV production. I'd say lately though, the most interesting thing they've had here recently, and they've already kind of chopped it up, was the Bloodline angle. Yep. That storyline was really good. It was getting really good, and it seemed like they were going in really good directions with it, but then it just kind of changed, and it's just how the business moves, because they have so many people to get to, so many stars, so many personalities that have to be involved in some way, shape, or form. And you know, what are they going to do? Go to the 5-hour TV show on Monday Night Raw or something? No, they can't do that. So everybody's got to kind of, it's a cyclical thing. It comes and goes. And
do you think that's a problem as well? If we stretch back to your day, you'd have guys that come in, enhancement guys, that would kind of obviously shine these guys up. Do you think that element is missing or could ever come back into the business? Or do you think that's dead and buried? Everyone needs to be a star. Everyone needs to make money. Everyone needs to make t-shirts. It's pretty much that, isn't it?
Those days are gone because, like you said, it's more of a production. Like you said, TV production. I said almost like a movie production. It seems that more emphasis is now put on the storylines and the promos. So putting guys out for a shine every episode doesn't won't pique anyone's interest anymore. People don't really want to see that, I don't think. So you've got to have situations put together in a fashion that makes it interesting to the fan that's watching. And it's done in such a way that, you know, two stars get in there and mix it up somehow, you know, they just find different ways to continue the storylines. That's all. I mean, that's in lots of promos, lots of talking, a lot of people out there trying to outdo each other with jokes and shit like that. You know, it's like,
A lot of commercials.
So, yeah, it's all about the money, but they're making a lot more money now.
Maybe hopefully they might do another battle royal this year, give you a call. What is it, 3 weeks? 3 weeks away?
I'll hobble my ass out there with one leg. I'll take that sumbitch off and beat somebody with it.
And that's something I could really picture on TV as well.
It's been done before too, though. Yeah, they had Maurice with Shawn, and it was Shawn Michaels versus Diesel. Diesel pulled off. Shawn was sitting at ringside. They pulled his fake leg off, and he went after Shawn with it. I don't think he hit him. I think Shawn hit Diesel with it in the end. But it's all been done.
Used it. They used it with Zach Gowen. You know Zach Gowen.
Yeah, there's another one. See? Everything's been done over and over and over.
Look, Duke, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you today on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully maybe we can do next time maybe a live show with the fans at some point.
Anytime, man. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun. So anytime you want to do this, just give me a holler and we'll do it again.
Yeah, and I will put your links for your podcast, which I'll get off you. I'm going to add you through Facebook now, and I'll put the links of your podcast underneath this video when it comes out so people can look at what you're up to. And thanks very much for your time again.
All right. Thank you very much, my friend.
Cheers, man.
See you.